I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. We'll start today with a conversation about the controversial proposal to impose mandatory sentences for illegal possession of a handgun in Baltimore. Lester Davis, spokesperson for City Council President Jack Young, tells us why he thinks it's a good idea. Councilman Brandon Scott will tell us why he thinks it isn't. Then Dr. K-Wise Whitehead and Liz Copeland join me. The Senate vote early this morning means the ACA isn't going anywhere. The Minneapolis police chief does go away after an officer shoots a white woman. The Mooch is off to a rough start as White House communications chief, and the Boy Scouts apologize for the president. Plus, acclaimed New York cabaret stars Eric Comstock and Barbara Fasano are playing at Germano's tonight. They'll tell us about the thing that makes a great tune tick. First, the news. Sounds from Tuesday's very heated City Council public committee hearing on a bill that proposed a mandatory one-year sentence for people caught carrying illegal handguns. The meeting erupted into chaos and confusion when several area university representatives were invited to testify before members of the public who'd been waiting to speak for hours. Two people were arrested during the hearing. The Judiciary and Legislative Investigations Committee voted 5-2 to advance the mandatory gun sentencing bill to the full council. Originally, the bill called for a one-year mandatory sentence for anyone caught with an illegal handgun within 100 yards of a school, a church, or other place of public assembly. After more than 6 hours of debate and testimony, the committee will pass along a watered-down version of the bill to the full council, who will take it up on August 14th. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to the Midday News Wrap. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Councilman Brandon Scott, one of the two members who voted against the bill. But first, we'll speak with Lester Davis. He's the Deputy Chief of Staff and the Director of Office of Policy and Communications for City Council President Jack Young. President Young is a proponent of the bill. Mr. Davis, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
So tell us how your boss, President Young, are feeling about the bill in its current form, which everyone seems to think is a much less strident version of the bill that you started with.
So I think, Tom, one of the things we first want to establish, and the president was pretty clear about this from the onset, starting with that Monday's introduction of the initial ordinance, that, you know, this was not about returning to the failed strategy of mass incarceration. We know that did not work. We know that that was a horrible mistake, especially and particularly for offenses that stem from drug addiction or drug crimes. What this was about was a tool to get folks who are the most dangerous among us off the street, a cooling out period, so that they could not be on the street wreaking havoc. And so I think, you know, answering your question about moving forward and what came out of the hearing that we had on Tuesday, I think it's pretty clear that it was democracy in action. So you had a council committee, I think, that was divided and had some concerns. Some folks had some concerns. Some folks were proponents. I think we heard from a number of citizens, some for, some against. And what came forward and what the full council is going to consider is, I think, a compromise piece of legislation. So, you know, democracy is often messy. I know you played the clip from the opening intro of the show. You had a lot of emotions were running high. People were very passionate, I think, on both sides of the issue. And I think from our perspective, moving forward, I mean, this is how a democracy works. You get folks who have, one side has an opinion. It's actually the thing that Washington is finding itself incapable of doing, the folks in the Baltimore City Council are actually being able to get done.
Does this come down to a sort of basic distrust of judges? I mean, does the City Council feel it needs to legislate and force the hand of people who are presiding over the trials of people who are accused of gun crimes? It just sounds like the City Council President Young and Mayor Pugh just don't trust the judiciary to take care of this issue.
Well, I don't know that it's as strong as a distrust of the judiciary. I think what the council president, certainly I can't necessarily speak for the mayor, but for the council president, the focus has been on, you know, we have a murder happening in our city, shootings happening in our city at a clip that is just intolerable. It is unconscionable, and it cannot stand. And so I think it's a tool to be able to stem some of those things. It's not, as some of the folks, and I've had these conversations with some of the folks who are against this measure, it is not a tool or an instrument to mass incarcerate folks. We know that that does not work. We're not in favor of that. The president's not in favor of that. He's been one of the people that's been pushing to reduce the levels that we arrest people and that we warehouse people in jails. So it's not about that. It's a tool to give police and the authorities so that they can take the folks who are committing the crimes off the street.
And are you convinced, are you confident that the legislation as it is worded now would in fact target those people who are the most violent criminals, and that this isn't going to end up simply being a sweep of people who are perhaps, you know, on the low end, the lower level of criminal activity in our city?
No, I don't think so. And I think one thing to keep in mind is that it is, as it stands right now, the act is already a crime. So we're not proposing a new crime. We're not proposing any new crime, if you will. It is an enhanced penalty to a crime that already exists. So it is already, if you carry an illegal gun and you're stopped by the police, you will be arrested today without this legislation being passed. It's an enhanced penalty for that, but it was never a new law, if you will, to kind of drag that or sweep folks up.
There are those who say that this actually is somewhat redundant to state law, which already provides a mandatory minimum 1-year sentence on a second handgun possession offense. What's your response to that?
So not quite. I mean, that has been I guess one of the talking points that's kind of been put out there. I mean, the Bullock amendment. This amendment was put forth by Councilman John Bullock. It deals with a, you know, in the commission of a violent crime. So you have someone who has shown you know, an escalation, if you will. They've graduated to continue to be involved in menacing crime, and there's also that fine that's a portion of it as well. So I think there's a pretty unique distinction in terms of someone who is shown that he or she is continuing down the criminal path and is likely escalating their behavior, which are those individuals we want to capture and stop.
The bill goes in front of the full council in a couple of weeks on the 14th of August. Do you expect that there will be further amendments to this bill?
It's likely. I mean, I can't say. I mean, that would be up to the members of the council. All, you know, all members have the ability to draft amendments and to put amendments forward. So it's likely that additional amendments would be offered.
Lester Davis is Deputy Chief of Staff and the Director of Office of Policy and Communications for City Council President Jack Young. Mr. Davis, thanks for your time. Appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
You too, Tom, and thanks for having me.
Thank you. Now we're going to turn to Councilman Brandon Scott, who joins us on the line from his office. He represents the 2nd District on the Baltimore City Council, where he serves as chair of the Public Safety Committee. And on Tuesday, he voted against the measure. Mr. Scott, welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, sir.
So if we don't have mandatory sentencing to get these a former police chief used to call the bad guys with guns off the streets, if not mandatory sentencing, what should we be doing to attack the clear problem of increased violence in our city?
Well, I think you start with a great point. So we all know that Commissioner Bielefeld is a person that said that we should attack bad guys with guns, and I brought it up in front of everyone at the hearing last week that during Commissioner Bielefeld's time as police commissioner, we had, you know, historic lows, including 2011, when we had 197 homicides in the city of Baltimore that we have already surpassed going into August. And we didn't have Commissioner Bielefeld wasn't walking around talking about mandatory minimums. It's about we are preached to that violence in the city of Baltimore is done by violent repeat offenders. And when I asked the question of the administration and the people for this bill, then why doesn't this bill target those people? They didn't have an answer. When I tried to amend the bill to target the violent repeat offenders only, that amendment was voted down. It was not supported. The truth is that mandatory minimums don't work. We know they don't work. The data is there that they don't work. But more importantly, in Baltimore, what we need is a comprehensive strategy for gun violence. And without that, this is just another throwing something at the wall to see if it sticks action. We know that the state, especially as amended, this bill is basically the same as the state law outside of the fine. So it's at this point even more unnecessary. And I think that what folks are saying is, listen, as a chair of the Public Safety Committee, I want the folks that are committing the crime to go and gun crimes to be punished more than anyone. But having this legislation is not going to change several facts. One, handgun arrests are down in the city of Baltimore. And when asked last week of the 455 at that period, at that time period of handgun violations arrests in the city of Baltimore, how many of them were violent repeat offenders? That information I have to wait to receive. When asked for the exact sentencing amount, so we've heard a lot about all these sentences that have been reduced, I want to see all of them. They're telling us about, oh, a guy who got 45 days or 60 days that should have gotten 4 years or 5 years. I want to see that list in its totality, because without that information, I don't know if the people that are being convicted and charged in the already existing laws are already serving on average over a year. So to me, it's about me being more comprehensive with our strategy, not just depending on the police department, but also figuring out, why aren't we arresting more violent repeat offenders with guns? How are we going to get back to where we were literally taking the bad guys with the guns off the streets? Because it wasn't that long ago that we saw this city having historic crime reductions each and every year, even in 2014, where we only had 211 homicides in the city of Baltimore, which is a number that we, at this rate, will eclipse before next week is over.
Right. And Councilman Commissioner Davis, Police Commissioner Kevin Davis, was quoted in the Baltimore Sun saying that more than 60% of people with gun convictions in the city since the beginning of 2016 have had more than half of those sentences suspended. So is there part of a comprehensive strategy that you envision that has anything to do with legislative pushing the hand or strongly imposing requirements on the judiciary?
So one that should be done at the state level. This is the only way. This is basically a loophole in state law that allowed the administration to put forth this legislation. But more importantly, that's the question that I asked the commissioner last week. I asked, okay, we know you're saying that they receive reduced sentences. Can you provide us with the complete list? Because I want to see for myself the complete list so I can see the actual time served, so that we can see what times are being served by what people for what crimes. And to tie that back to the violent repeat offenders, who are the violent repeat offenders serving, 3 and 4 year sentences on average, and the other folks are not. This is what we want to see. And that's why, in my opinion, we were not even given enough information and enough data about what's going on with arrests and handgun arrests in the city of Baltimore to even have voted on the bill on Tuesday.
In your mind, what are the elements of a comprehensive plan to address the violence in our city?
Oh, it's everything. It's everything from education to employment and workforce development, health. In my opinion, gun violence is a disease, and it should be treated as such. It's a health disease. If I'm a young man and like I am, and my granddad has prostate cancer, what does my doctor check me for every time I go to the doctor? Prostate cancer. Well, young men in this city are growing up, and their fathers and their brothers have all been the victims of gun violence, and we don't intercede in that. And that's what we have to start doing, so that it doesn't just fall at the foot of the police. We're asking our police officers to do way too much. We're asking them to be social service people, health providers. They don't need to do that. We have to look at public safety and gun violence as a disease and attack it from a public health point of view.
What about the folks who say that's true, everybody agrees with that, but that is a long-term, perhaps generational generational approach? What are we going to do about what's happening now?
So this is two things. One, this bill isn't going to do anything for right now. No, I just want to go on the record and letting people know that anyone that says that, threatening a hardened criminal and a killer in Baltimore City with a year gun crime is going to make them not carry a gun is losing their mind. They're insane. It's just not going to happen. But public health approaches are also immediate. Safe streets is a public health approach, and it's been shown to have great results in reducing shootings in their areas by 26% and mediating and preventing Lord knows how many more. Those are the things, some of the things that we should be doing immediately. And we have to remember that it was the city council that had to save this public health approach from being cut out of the budget when Baltimore was having its biggest crime increase in history.
Councilman Brandon Scott represents the 2nd District on the Baltimore City Council, where he is the chair of the Public Safety Committee. Councilman, thanks for your time. I appreciate it, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up after a break, Dr. K.Wise Whitehead of Loyola University Maryland and Liz Copeland of the Urban Conservative Project join me for the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Midday on your public radio. This is member-supported 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today it's the Midday News Wrap. By the way, coming up on the program Monday, bioethicist Dr. Jeff Kahn is going to stop by for a conversation about the ethical questions surrounding the case of little Charlie Gard. He's an infant in the UK with a rare genetic condition that's left him brain damaged and unable to move or breathe on his own. He's in hospice at this hour, and it's expected that life support will be withdrawn from him soon. We'll talk about his parents' legal battle to seek treatment for their son and what it means to act in the best interest of a critically ill child who can't speak for him or herself. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Dr. K.Wise Whitehead and Liz Copeland join me here in Studio A. Dr. K. is an associate professor of communication and African and African-American studies at Loyola University, Maryland, the founding executive director of the Emily Frances Davis Center for Education, Research, and Culture. She's the author of a whole bunch of books, the most recent one, Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. Dr. K., good to see you.
As always, thank you so much.
And Liz Copeland is the founder and president of the Urban Conservative Project, an organization for centrist political activists. Liz, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
If you would like to join our conversation with Dr. K. and Liz, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org, our Twitter handle at midday. Tom Hall. Liz Copeland, what do you think about this conversation we just had with Mr. Davis, who represents Council President Young, and Councilman Scott about this mandatory sentencing? Jeff Sessions, described by the president as the beleaguered, head of the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, was bragging just yesterday about how defendants charged with unlawful possession of a firearm increased nearly 23% in the 2nd quarter. This is a priority for him. We should say, by the way, that what we mean by a legal handgun is an unregistered handgun. So
right.
it's not on the books.
I think so much. I mean, where do I begin? I mean, everybody wants to be safer in Baltimore City, and I think that's a very serious issue right now. Gun arrests are down 31% this year. More than 500 people have been shot. We already talked about the murder rate, 200. The violent crime that's associated with illegal guns is having a severe impact on our city. But I've said before, as an NRA member, I think that there's been this conversation around gun control and gun rights where a lot of the public see all guns and people who own guns as bad guys. And you referenced the former commissioner who said bad guys doing bad things with guns. And we don't have a conversation about legally carrying guns and supporting African-American men and women who want to exercise a Second Amendment right. We've always talked about guns in Baltimore City, for the most part, as the root cause of poverty, as the root cause of all the economic despair in this city. And while it is true, I agree with Councilman Scott, that it is a public health issue. There is a public health issue related to gun violence. That's not the only causal factor.
Should we be encouraging more guns, more registered
guns? You're talking
guns?
To an NRA member, yes.
Yeah.
I think everyone who is legally able to submit a registration form and can comply with a criminal background check and a mental health check, that they should be able to access guns and be able to carry in the state of Maryland, and we can't. But that's not what's happening in Baltimore City. You have people who are intending to commit crimes and who are getting caught with guns and through our criminal justice system, and because of the amount of cases that are being presented to judges, that they are now giving more than one chance to go back out and do what they originally intended to do, which I would posit is to commit a crime. But the problem with this law is that we're allowing or we're asking our elected officials to be judge, jury, and executioner when it comes to these crimes. And I think we need to take a deeper look at the judges and the types of judges. We elect our circuit court judges in Baltimore City. No one's really talking about that. I understand the city council is attempting to do something. This bill, as it came out, does nothing. There is, and even the Koch Foundation talks about the over-criminalization in America. We have so many laws, we don't even know how many we have in the country and in Baltimore City. This is a repeat. This is just a repetition of the state law. It really doesn't do anything.
And Dr. K, when you've got folks like Rand Paul and Cory Booker on the same side of an issue, about, concerned about the high incarceration rates, incarceration is clearly a problem. It's been a problem for generations. However, the police chief says the only way to make the streets safer are take these guys, and they're almost all guys, and get them off the street. They are walking around with guns. The guns are illegal, but as you know, Liz is saying, they have the intent to commit crimes. And unless you get the people who intend to shoot other people off the street and incarcerated, you can't fix the problem.
Well, just to unpack that question a little bit, because there's a lot in that question that you put. One is around, you know, mass incarceration and looking at this in terms of the crime that it is. The fact that we are gutting people's families, we're pulling people out of their communities. We are doing this straight, you know, classroom to prison pipeline. Recidivism rates are very high, and there's nothing being done to interrupt that. Now, this bill does not talk about that, but I do think once we lay mass incarceration on the table, that people should begin to unpack that and think about Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and what does that mean to have such a high number of African-American males primarily, and now we're seeing, of course, females on the rise going into the prison system and kind of in this circular motion from the prison to their community, from the community back to their prison, and we're not disrupting that cycle. So I wanted to lay that out. Second is something
a lot of folks are here, will hear that, of course, and it's absolutely true. It's unimpeachable. But if they're the people who are shooting other people,
right.
But shouldn't they be off the street? Shouldn't they have their families disrupted? Shouldn't they be in jail?
I absolutely agree with that. If we looked and said that the number of people who are in prison are there because they shot people, that is why they're in prison, then I agree with that. But we know there's a myriad of issues why people are in prison who probably shouldn't be there. Sometimes we're dealing with DNA results that are wrong. Sometimes we're dealing with being over-criminalized for small offenses.
Minor drug offenses.
Right. Spending years in prison. I'm not talking about the people that are shooting, which I think is a different issue. And I want to talk about the second thing that Liz put out in terms about being registered to carry a handgun. Is that correct? I am not a member of the NRA. I believe guns should be off the street. I definitely have some issues around the Second Amendment. I know that's not what's happening in Baltimore City. That is a separate issue, but I do want to state where I stand on that. And third and most importantly, we're living in a city where over 500 people have been shot this year. We need to have some results. I am not saying this particular bill is a result of that. I'm saying we need to have a solution that needs to be put in place. I think I need to also say...
And if you have any idea, let me ask you the same question I asked Brandon Scott. I mean, what are the elements of a comprehensive plan that can address this problem in the short term?
Well, I want to say with answering that, I do want to say that I've recently become a Baltimore City Commissioner, that I work for the Community Relations Commission. And we look at what is happening in employment. We look at what's happening in the community. We look at all these terms in terms of civil rights and what we can do. So with that in mind and understanding my new position, I'm trying to take a very deep and thoughtful approach to this. What can we do to solve this issue? This is a long-standing issue in Baltimore City. This is not new. We have seen this issue kind of float in and out. I agree with what the commissioner said, that we're talking about a mental health problem. We're talking about a community health problem. We're talking about a public health problem. We're talking about the need for more education. We're talking about the need to have places for young people to go after school. We need to talk about the ways in which the family structure has been disrupted and people feel the need to be in the street. We need to talk about the fact that we're dealing with food deserts and people are economically challenged, the rising unemployment rates. All of these factors combined deal with what we're seeing on the street. I don't think one solution is what we need. I think we need a number of short-term solutions and long-term situations as well.
And Liz Copeland is taking away the discretion of judges as a matter of public policy and political philosophy, a good idea. Is it appropriate for a city council or the state legislature to say to the judges before the cases even come before them that when the case comes before them and a verdict is a certain way, you got to do this, rather than say, we trust you as an individual to make the best judgment in this individual case?
My emotional response as a Baltimore City resident and a mother of three Black children, two of them boys, well, young men now, I would say that, you know, it sounds right to put this mandatory minimum because I want to be safer. So I don't really care, you know, what happens with this judge who may or may not come to the bench with his own predetermined bias. But as a fact finder, we know that the data has shown us it doesn't work. Mandatory minimums, these sentencing guidelines that they did on a federal level, led to mass incarceration in this country. And as a conservative, you know, we expanded government. We want limited government. We reduced individual rights and freedom by doing that, and it cost us more. So you have this knee-jerk reaction in Baltimore City, I believe, that we need to do something, and this is what we need to do, because I do believe it's an issue of trusting the process and trusting the people. There is some distrust with, clearly, with the police department. There is some distrust with the judicial system that they're not going to do the job. And then you intersect the state's attorney's office who, you know, they put forth a great case and they can't get a conviction, be it a jury or a bench trial. I think there may be some distrust with the city council. But it's interesting that Councilman Scott, who, you know, for full disclosure, I consider him a personal friend. I think he's skirting away from his responsibility. The leaders of our city include the city council. It's not just the mayor, the city council president, and the police commissioner. It's all of them. They need to come up with a comprehensive plan. It's not for the mayor or the police commissioner to do that.
A lot of folks calling for a plan and nobody calling for specific things.
Right. They need to give us, and they need to give the citizens an outline of this plan. And you're right. It needs, my colleague to the right, you're right. We need to have a comprehensive plan that includes all of the social service issue, the education. But at the end of the day, people are responsible for the actions that they are involved in. And
no,
this is an attempt.
Yes, we are
responsible for our personal actions.
But I'm thinking about when we talk about people born into a certain community who are dealing with the cycle of poverty, who grow up in a situation where they don't have access to all the things we just laid out. And then when they make certain decisions, which are based upon a lifetime of being denied certain rights, certain access, and we go, well, you have to be responsible rather than taking a long
hard
look
at
history to see what has happened. And there is a very serious distrust of those who are in power in this city, which is why that council meeting erupted in the way that it did. I'm thinking when we talk long-term solutions, we talk from the community up. There are some activists here in this city who are trying to find ways to interrupt, to disrupt, to intervene with what is happening in the community from the ground up, rather than just policies from the top down. Again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if that were the case, then all African-Americans would be shooting each other. I mean, Black people have been poor for years.
I
respectfully disagree. Mm-hmm. I think that in Baltimore City, there absolutely was a history of not having support from their elected officials and not getting the resources that they needed. But all African Americans aren't committing crimes. All Black boys are out here shooting each other. There are some who are doing it, and they need to be held accountable for their actions because they are disrupting our entire city.
All right, we're going to change topics here. Speaking of long histories, the long and sordid history of the ACA had another magnificent moment early this morning. The Republicans
put on a skinny
repeal didn't make it through the Senate. There were Republicans like Lindsey Graham who said this is a terrible bill, it's a rotten idea, and then he voted for it. I mean, just the process here. Senator McCain, who's now been elevated at least for these last 48 hours as a hero again, you know, advocating for what he calls regular order. I mean, what happened in the Senate last night was extraordinary on so many levels that, you know, people were voting for a bill that they hoped wouldn't pass. And then they said, well, we get it to conference in the Congress, we can fix it then, as if the 7 years that have, you know, happened so far weren't enough time to come up with a plan. Talk about folks who don't have a comprehensive plan. I mean, it seems that most of Obamacare has become popular.
But I think it's interesting to talk about repealing something or letting it implode, I think is the word that the president used. Let it just, it's going to implode anyway, then we'll talk about fixing it without looking at the people behind the numbers. When you start talking about getting rid of health care, there are real people behind this who have a risk of not having access to getting their medicines, to getting the long-term care that they need. I mean, they're voting, at least senators and Republicans and Democrats that we vote for are voting with the idea they hope it's not going to pass without looking at the real impact. I think there was a lot of tension happening and drama happening on the floor. I think it was even playing out more on social media when people who had vested interests were staying up and watching what they don't typically tune into because they were concerned that their lives were on the line. That's what happens when you don't have a long-term plan and you're just trying to see whatever is going to work for the moment, which is the same thing we're talking about with Baltimore City.
Mm-hmm. Liz Copeland, as a conservative, are the Republicans going to own this? Are the Republicans going to be, in fact, chided and punished for not passing a bill that appears to have something under 20% support nationally?
I don't think that those two options are mutually exclusive. I think it's both. I think we own it. I think the Republicans own it. I think that they will repeal it. I mean, we talked about, you know, having a bill come over so they could bring it up for conference. And for the very intelligent listening audience that you have, I'm just repeating this just for those who may not understand that the Senate is asking for the House to agree to not vote on the bill just so they can talk about it. But we've kind of talked about it ad nauseum.
But the bill didn't pass, so that ain't happening
anymore
either.
Right, that's not going to happen at all.
Right, so we're talking 7 years. I believe that they are going to repeal the individual mandate. It's essentially the exact same thing, whatever you want to call Trump care or America care. I don't care what they call it.
But
it's going to be Obamacare without the individual
mandate. How do you repeal the
mandate
and have a pool that doesn't make the insurance market implode?
You don't. You don't. The problem is that the 20 million people who are going to lose their coverage, it just tugs at the heartstring, right? But we're talking about 15 million who didn't want it in the first place. They were forced to go into these exchanges. But without them, you can't have premiums at the rate that people who think Kentucky Care is not the Affordable Care Act,
right,
because they love their Kentucky Care, but they want to get rid of Obamacare. It's so much misinformation.
But the 15 million people don't want it now.
Right.
But when one of those 15 million people is in a car accident,
then they want it.
Then they want it.
Right, but
I mean,
when we talk
about personal responsibility, right, isn't there some responsibility to everybody else?
That's an issue of morality. It's your morals that say that those people need to have it. But the individual rights proponents would say, if I don't want health insurance and I get into an accident, then I am responsible for my failures and I am responsible for my successes. And we shouldn't legislate morality, especially in healthcare, because people, it's a fiscal note that's attached to that and people have to pay for it. But you and I know, everyone listening knows, without healthier people, then the premiums will continue to skyrocket. Without the balance within these exchanges, more insurance companies are going to leave the exchanges and the prices are going to continue to go up. Unfortunately, conservatives and Republicans made a commitment to repeal Obamacare. We're coming up into 2018. We want to maintain the White House for 2020. They are going to repeal something and say on the bottom of their campaign literature,
they're going to say
we repealed Obamacare. And everyone who's going to read what they finally repealed, they removed one small portion and slapped the word repeal on it.
And that's why people need to be aware of what's going on. Because if you just listen to what's coming out of the news, you listen to them saying repeal and not looking at the small thing they have done, then you get confused. And I think that when you start
confusion is fun in politics.
I mean,
what are you talking
about? I mean, confusion is what they're dealing with. I don't think you can mandate morality, but I do think we should talk about the humanity attached to this. What is our responsibility to our citizens who don't have the money to afford health care on their own and who are benefiting from what they're calling Obamacare, which gets people confused when you attach it to a man rather than looking at the Affordable Health Care
Act. Well, Senator McConnell says he's moving on. Mm-hmm. So now it's on to tax reform. And, of course, we still need a continuing resolution to keep the government open,
yes,
too. That hasn't been worked out. Today is the 100th anniversary of the Silent Parade of 1917, organized by the NAACP. 10,000 African-Americans marched down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan silently to protest lynching and racial violence. Lynching per se, not in the news, but racial violence continuing to be in the news, Kay Whitehead. Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Hartaux resigned about a week ago after one of her officers shot a woman who evidently had called 911.
Yes.
The difference between this shooting and many of the others is that she's white. The others have been black. What do you make of that?
Well, she's white. And then this is also the first time when we find out the religion of the cop who shot her. We're talking about a Somali Muslim cop who shot her. I think E.R. Shipp's op-ed in the Baltimore Sun talking about the fact that America doesn't pay attention until it happens to a white woman. So now that a white woman has been shot by a police officer, people are in the streets demanding for a change, demanding that they turn on, their
cameras,
the body cameras that they are voluntarily not using, demanding that there is some accountability, demanding for the police chief to resign, which did happen, demanding that the city take a close look at what police officers are doing and the rogue behavior. I am not saying I was going to say, I don't agree with what happened, the shooting across your partner, having an unholstered gun in the car with you. I am not agreeing with that. I am saying the issue that we're talking about now is the same issue that we've been raising in Black Lives Matter for 4 years, that people have been pushing against and saying that there was no validity to it, speaking out against it, mocking and ridiculing people who are saying we need to take a hard look at the work that police officers are doing and hold them accountable for their behavior.
Isn't this incident, however, an argument that the police, in fact, are not acting racially? They're shooting anybody. They're shooting white people. They're shooting black people. They're just shooting in situations in which they had other options.
Well, if you go back and you look at Black Lives Matter, you're talking 4 years ago, that was the argument that was being made, that we are all in danger when police officers are acting in rogue ways. It's not just happening to the black community, but we need to draw attention to it. People made Black Lives Matter as Black Lives Matter only rather than Black Lives Matter too, and focus only on what was happening in the black community. Perhaps with this particular shooting, people are saying, oh, we do need to look at that. Unfortunately, it took this shooting to get people to take this as a real issue. It's not a real issue until it happens to someone outside of the African-American community, as is evidenced by what just occurred in the last week or so. Mm-hmm.
And of course, the officer was, as you say,
a Somali Muslim,
a person of color. We just got a couple of minutes left. Liz, I want to talk about Anthony Scaramucci, who his amazing interview with Ryan Lizza in The New Yorker, in which it was this profanity-laden tirade against people like Reince Priebus and stuff. Here's a guy who's supposed to be the communications director for the White House. You've got a president who stands in front of the Boy Scouts and essentially has to get his hand slapped after he makes a speech, which is wholly inappropriate by almost anybody's standards, Boy Scouts or not. Mr. Scaramucci has his share of peccadillos in the closet. I mean, he's trying to sell his company to a Chinese company. This is the reason Reince Priebus didn't want him in the White House in the first place. Trump overruled his chief of staff. What do you make of this mess that's going on in that office?
It's so embarrassing as a conservative to see we have a Republican president and he behaves in this manner. Reince Priebus, when he was in the head of the RNC, he worked really hard to fund college Republican chapters at historically black colleges and universities. He worked really hard to coordinate the communication with members of black press and held monthly conference calls. You hear nothing from the RNC now since he's been gone, and you kind of really don't hear much from him.
Yeah.
In the White House, I remember when Rahm Emanuel was, you know, the chief of staff to former President Barack Obama, and he had a very large presence in the White House, and you felt that there was a true governing body in there helping the president make these decisions. But the Trump White House, the Trump rewards a macho, and Trump, by former employees, has been known to pit employees against each other and pick the winners and losers and kind of have this very combative, competitive nature, which may work well for, television, The Apprentice, but it is not appropriate in the White House. And I am appalled at the communication director's communication style.
Yeah. He's quite the communicator. All right. Well, you got 1,000 other things to talk about and no time to do it. So I appreciate it. Have a great weekend, you guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. K. Wise Whitehead is an associate professor of communications and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland, and the author, most recently, of Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. Liz Copeland is the founder and president of the Urban Conservative Project. That's an organization for centrist political activists. We got links on the web, WIPR.org/midday. Coming up, after a break. A conversation with New York cabaret stars Eric Comstock and Barbara Fasano. They're playing Germanos tonight, and they will be here in Studio A in exactly 90 seconds. I'm Tom Hall, I promise. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Midday with Tom Hall on your public radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR.